Hello, please welcome Shackley's Vice President of Health Science, Les Wong.
Hi, everybody. Les Wong here with my colleagues and partners, Pam Riggs, Torrance Rogers, and Nell Prentice from our Health Sciences Department. We gave Dr. Jamie the night off tonight, as she's doing these all the time, but I can assure you that we're in capable hands. We have some great topics that we want to touch base on tonight, so why don't we go ahead and just get started. As you know, it's April, it's spring, the weather's warming up here, it's really nice to be outside, and there's a couple special things that happened this month. One of them is Earth Day, and one of the things I like to talk about Earth Day is really sort of highlighting Shackley's continuing environmental stewardship in this area. As you know, there's only one Earth, and we have to do all that we can to protect it. That goes beyond reducing and recycling. It means reconsidering our options and changing the ways we think and do things. It could be biking to work. It could be walking to work, using energy-efficient light bulbs, or even switching to environmentally friendly household cleaning products. You know, the environmental heritage of Shackley dates back for more than 50 years, which is a whole decade before the actual Earth Day was actually established. The company was the first in the world to be defined as climate neutral, certified in 2000, and was recognized as an industry innovator by the nonprofit group Climate Counts. In 2006, Shackley initiated a nationwide campaign called A Million Trees, A Million Dreams, in collaboration with 2004 Nobel Peace Prize laureate Dr. Wangari Maathai. As part of the campaign, Shackley distributors set out to plant a million trees throughout North America, and we were all here when the millionth tree was planted on Earth Day in 2009, right here at company headquarters, Shackley World Headquarters in Pleasanton, California, with Roger Barnett, Wangari Maathai, and all of our corporate employees here. Well, this year it's 2012, and we invite you to celebrate Earth Day the Shackley way, and at the same time, do your best to remember Professor Wangari Maathai. It's a tradition. Each year, Shackley family members throughout the U.S. and Canada celebrate Earth Day by taking action locally to make a difference for the health of the planet in our very own communities, while also sharing the story of Shackley and our more than 50 years of environmental leadership. This year, we'll also be honoring the memory of our late friend and inspiration, Professor Wangari Maathai, Nobel Peace Laureate, and the only person to ever win the Nobel Prize for her work on behalf of the environment, and the only honorary Shackley Master Coordinator in our history. You can play an important role in our celebration of Earth Day and Wangari, and here's how. One, if you plan an Earth Day event in your area to introduce everyone you know to Shackley, our more than 50 years of leading the way and doing the right thing for the planet, and our safe, powerful, green, and smart earth-friendly products. Plan to hold your event on April 21st or any time near Earth Day, which is going to be on Sunday, April 22nd. Make tree planting a part of your event and help us make a big contribution to the Green Belt Movement, the I Am the Hummingbird campaign, which is an ambitious goal to plant 1 billion trees worldwide in Wangari Maathai's honor. Make sure to register your 2012 Earth Day event and tree planting with Shackley. We'll publish your event location and contact information on our meeting calendar online, and there's no cost to register, no mailing or shipment associated with these events. And now I'd like to talk about another topic that's very related to Earth Day and keeping the planet a safe and healthy and vibrant place. And that's our commitment to clean water and, first of all, BPA-free packaging. Interestingly enough, and as some of you might have heard, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, ruled on Friday, March 30th, that it would not ban bisphenol A or BPA in food packaging, citing a lack of sufficient scientific evidence to make the decision. A very disappointing response for us, and this came 4 years after the Natural Resources Defense Council, or the NRDC, brought the petition to the FDA for consideration. Well, while the agency didn't outlaw the toxin, FDA said it would continue to consider the safety of BPA. Well, the chemical's been linked to altered toddler behavior, miscarriage, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, erectile dysfunction, and according to the NRDC, also early puberty. In fact, a New York Times article was puberty before age 10 a new normal, and that article actually reported that about 93% of Americans have traces of BPA in our bodies. So BPA, which has been around since 1891, was first used as a synthetic estrogen in the 1930s. In the 50s, manufacturers added the substance to hard plastics, and now BPA is often found in hard plastic bottles, food and beverage cans, in linings of certain steel food-containing cans, and also, amazingly enough, in some cash register receipts as well. Well, there are countries and companies moving away from BPA. Actually, Shackley did this many years ago and has committed to BPA-free packaging for many, many years now. In 2010, Canada declared BPA toxic and banned it from baby bottles. This past February, France upheld a BPA ban, which will likely drive EU legislation and make it impossible for U.S. food manufacturers to continue selling BPA-laced cans in Europe. And last October in the U.S., right here in California, our state banned the sale of baby bottles and sippy cups containing BPA. And we applaud that move because we don't want any more exposure, particularly to our young ones, through the baby bottles and cups that they're often in contact with. So in terms of tips, general tips and guidelines for trying to avoid contact BPA, and in the wake of the FDA's decision, there are some ways you can keep yourself safe and educate your consumers about BPA. In fact, the Environmental Working Group offers certain tips for lessening BPA exposure. Number one, you can avoid polycarbonates that are marked with recycling code number 7 or noted with the letters PC. Plastics that are labeled number 1, number 2, number 4 are probably better choices from a safety standpoint. You can switch away from plastic containers and switch to glass jarred foods. And better yet, opt for some of the new great stainless steel water bottles that don't have a liner, and avoid using old or scratched plastic bottles now. What we see typically here at home office is we have these great Shackley water bottles that are now these white wide mouth water bottles. They're great. Pam has always carried her Muir Woods water bottle around for as long as I can remember, many, many years, a nice stainless steel water bottle, being very green, being very healthy and good for the planet as well. Pregnant women and children should limit consumption of canned foods, as probably we all should. And obviously there's a time and a place and moderation in all things, a time and a place for some of these things, but we should all strive to eat more fresh foods and more plant foods in our diet, and we'll be better off, and so will our planet. Choose powdered formula for babies rather than liquid formula, as FDA tests have found that metal cans can actually leach BPA into liquid baby formula. And in terms of use of plastics, again, I mentioned this, we want to try to cut down on this. And one of the places where you can cut down is keeping plastics out of the microwave. Even plastics that are labeled microwave safe are probably best not exposed to repeated heating and microwave exposure, as this can hasten the breakdown of the plastics and may lead to, again, increased exposure to these things. There are other things that you can do. I talked about minimizing use of canned foods and drinks. One of the things when you're looking at containers, again, use glass. When you're looking for safer plastic containers, note that the soft or cloudy colored plastics do not contain BPA, so that they're probably a little bit better for you. All right, now I want to segue a little bit into what is important to look for in a non-BPA form, and that is our water, and looking for clean water and looking for ways to access and to clean the water that's accessible to you. So let me just dive into a little bit of information on, just some background on water. The water you drink is one of the most critical nutrients for your overall health. A major component of virtually all of the body's tissues, organs, and fluids, water plays an important role in a host of crucial body functions. And that's why health experts recommend drinking, you know, 8-ounce glasses of water every day to help maintain optimum hydration and optimum health. But a recent study showed that the average person may drink less than 5 glasses of water per day, and many of us are in a fairly constant state of you know, a little bit of dehydration. In addition, some people may face greater challenges in maintaining optimum hydration, including athletes, the elderly, people on weight loss diets, those with exposure in the summertime, those maybe using diuretic medications. And unlike a camel, the human body can't store the water we require for metabolism. And that's why it's essential that water must be taken in frequently. In fact, water is way more vital to the body than food. I hate to say it, but it's true. It's estimated that adults of normal weight can live about 70 days without food, but even in a moderate climate, you can't live 10 days without water. Well, water is a component of every cell in the body. Muscle and organ cells have the highest concentration of water, up to 75%, while bone and fat mass contain only about 20% water. And in all, water accounts for 50 to 60% of an adult's body weight. About two-thirds of the body's water is contained within cells. The rest of the body's fluid is extracellular, or that's surrounding the cells, like in the blood, the lymph, the brain, and GI fluids. Water is essential to a wide variety of crucial body functions, including regulating body temperature through evaporation of sweat, respiration, transporting nutrients and oxygen throughout the body through your bloodstream, elimination of cellular and body waste, digestion and conversion of food into energy, as a lubricant along mucous membranes and between moving parts, and cushioning of those vital joints and vital organs and joints, and as a solvent that dissolves other substances in body fluid. So now that we know water is critically, critically important for us, what are the concerns that we have this day and age with regard to safety and cleanliness of our water? Well, here's a couple of facts that you might want to know. First, an environmental working group study found that a total of 316 contaminants, including 97 agricultural and 204 industrial contaminants in the tap water of 45 states. In fact, more than half of the contaminants detected have no drinking water safety standards at all. According to the US EPA, public water utilities have violated the Safe Drinking Water Act for more than 700,000 times in the past 7 years. Unlike public water utilities, the bottled water industry is not required to publicly disclose the results of any contaminant testing it conducts. Bottled water may not be contaminant-free either. The EWG found a total of 38 contaminants in the water of 10 popular brands. And also in 2007, 8.8 billion gallons of bottled water were consumed in the U.S., and that including all over 1.64 million tons, 1.64 million tons of bottled water packaging materials, you know, that lid that end up in our environment. And although most of these bottles are recyclable, only about one-third of these bottles end up getting recycled. The rest end up getting into landfills and other places as well. So one of the best ways we can think of to help you control and improve and assure that you're getting clean, safe, healthy, fresh water is through some of the new water filtration technologies that are available. One of the things you want to do is make sure your water filters are filtering for the right contaminants, for the right things, particularly for your area. So look for water filtration that is certified by the Water Quality Association or the WQA. Look for filtration systems that are certified to reduce dozens of harmful contaminants, including lead. Some of the top filter names don't filter out any lead at all. There are other heavy metals that you'll want your filter to go after, and that includes mercury and cadmium. There are disinfection byproducts that you'll want your filter to be specific for, and that will include total trihalomethanes, chloroform, bromoform, and haloketones. As well, there are agricultural pollutants, depending on where you live, but these could include atrazine, atchlor, carbofuran, methoxychlor, cymosine, endrin, lindane, 2,4-D, 2,4-5-TP. And, of course, there are industrial pollutants. Again, depending on where you live, you may see more or less of this in your environment. But there are benzene, chlorobenzene, dichlorobenzene, toluene, styrene, xylenes, carbon tetrachloride, hexachlorobutadiene, trichloroethylene, and many, many more contaminants and things that you want to be filtering out of your water. So make sure you're looking for a filtration system that handles as many of these contaminants as possible. We also know of a filtration system that uses actually a recyclable or refillable cartridge, and there's one in the industry now that does that. That's also another green approach to ensuring that you have the cleanest, safest water available. And, of course, you need to make sure that your pitcher and your filter materials are BPA-free for the greatest assurance of safety and health. All right, now with that, I'm going to pass the baton over to Pam, who is going to talk to you about some of the latest interesting finds in the area and the science of nutrition. Pam?
Thank you, Les. And probably after my next section, people are going to be afraid to eat and drink all kinds of things. So I'm going to share some interesting news that I read that came from a study from the Johns Hopkins Center for Livable Future. And this has to do with the safety of our seafood supply. And I guess I'll just start by saying, you know, if you're like most health conscious people, and certainly we from Health Sciences promote, encourage people to eat more fish to get, you know, omega-3 fatty acids, and there's lots of messaging around eating more fish these days to get the heart health benefits from the omega-3s. But many of you may not realize that what comes along with some of that seafood are things that aren't so welcome, like contaminants. And, you know, traditionally we've been concerned about heavy metals and PCBs, and from this new Johns Hopkins Center report, they mentioned a study that was published in Environmental Science and Technology last November that analyzed government-collected seafood inspection data from the U.S., from Europe, from Japan, and Canada between the years of 2000 and 2009. And some interesting facts that came from that research. Well, one of them is that about 85% of the seafood that we as Americans consume is imported, and much of that is farm-raised a practice called aquaculture. Oftentimes in Asia and elsewhere in developing countries. And the problem that's being identified is that these other countries may have different standards for aquaculture. In fact, some of these countries use drugs that are banned here in their processes in these overseas fish farms, and they're not regularly inspected by U.S. officials. So that's a little bit scary. And only a fraction of imported seafood is actually tested for drug residues when it enters the country. And in fact, the FDA checks just 2% of imported seafood for contaminants, including drug residues, microbes, and heavy metals. And the study reported that compared to 20 to 50% in Europe and 18% in Japan and up to 15% in Canada. So, you know, FDA is only looking at 2% of the seafood that is imported. And to make matters worse, when they looked at what FDA was actually inspecting for, it looks at only residues from about 13 different drugs, in contrast to Europe that tests for 34 drugs. So basically, you know, a large percentage of overseas fish farms can use, you know, a range of drugs that the U.S. we don't even screen for. And last spring, the U.S. Government Accountability Office reported that only, you know, 0.1% of imported seafood was inspected specifically for drug residues in 2009. So, you know, and they concluded that FDA's oversight of the safety of imported seafood is limited, is in their mind an understatement, indeed. On top of the list of offending seafood is shrimp and prawns. They most commonly exceeded the drug residue limits the most frequently. The most other problematic imported seafood included crab, bassa, which is a type of catfish, eel, and tilapia. And tilapia is commonly used. You'll find that in your marketplace, in restaurants, and most of all, likely, you know, from farmed fish. Of all the countries, Vietnam had the most drug violations, followed by China and other countries in Asia, including Thailand, Indonesia, Taiwan, India, and Malaysia. And when I'm talking about drugs, you know, they use things like antibiotics and antifungals and antiparasitics, as well as pesticides and disinfectants, to kind of help control for diseases that spread rampantly in these crowded fish farms. And while, you know, they know that exposure to some of these substances can pose a health risk to people who are actually working in these fish farms, you know, we don't fully know the health effects of the chronic low exposure from eating fish with these drug residues. We do know, you know, typically that antibiotics, you know, that have come from aquaculture could contribute to the development of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and that is a problem here, you know, for people in terms of causing antibiotic drugs to become less effective. In terms of other contaminants in seafood, you know, this report also revealed that it's not just limited to farmed fish from developing countries. They cited another study in Science in 2004 that found that farmed salmon from Europe had the most PCBs and other potentially harmful industrial pollutants, while Chilean farmed salmon had less. So that just shows that the problem in aquaculture occurs in developing countries as well. Larger wild caught fish like swordfish have high levels of mercury. So, you know, the problem isn't solely related to you know, less developed countries. You know, with all of the, you know, push by the, for U.S. dietary guidelines, American Heart Association, World Health Organization, you know, to recommend that people eat fish at least twice a week to get, you know, omega-3 fatty acids, you know, it can be a challenge with all the things that we have to be concerned about from the fish supply. Another important thing to note is that, you know, there has been some legislation, the 2011 Food Safety Modernization Act, which includes some provisions to help the FDA better monitor imported seafood, but the outlook is not so great given the budgetary constraints of the FDA, so, you know, nobody expects a quick fix on this. So it means that it's up to you to choose your fish wisely, and your best recourse is to limit exposure to potentially drug residues is to look for primarily domestically farmed seafood based on what the Johns Hopkins study had revealed. Certain wild-caught fish are good options. The Seafood Watch program that's here in the Monterey Bay area of California has put together a list of super green, ocean-friendly, high omega-3 fatty acid but low contaminant type of fish to consume, and they suggest farmed oysters, wild-caught sardines, rainbow trout that's been farmed is okay, wild salmon from Alaska, fresh coho salmon that's farmed in the U.S., and other healthy green choices include Arctic char, which is farmed, barramundi, which is farmed in the U.S., and farmed mussels. So those were some of their suggestions. Some other tips in terms of fish intake, they suggest that you choose fish that come from the lower chain, like anchovies, mackerel, and sardines, because they're smaller and they tend to have less contaminants in them. They also recommend that you vary your seafood choices so you're not overexposing yourself to any particular one type of contaminant. They do recommend wild salmon as a good choice. And to try to buy from a local fish market, somebody that's been in business for a long time that buys direct from distributors, that you can ask specific questions about where the fish came from. So, you know, even though the, you know, there are, oh, I know it is, there are country of origin labeling, which you'll see, like, if you go to your market, typically it says, you know, where the fish came from. And what's interesting about that, too, that legislation went into effect in 2005, but it only requires supermarkets to do that, not restaurants, not processed fish products, or, oddly enough, it doesn't apply to fish markets. So, you know, it's a real challenge in terms of really understanding where your fish is coming from. But if you can find a local fish market and be able to ask questions and go to a trusted resource, is your best bet. And, of course, you know, this, all of this leads to the rationale for taking fish oil supplements. And, you know, that's certainly something that we in Health Sciences recommend. It's a great way to get your omega-3 fatty acids and reduce your, you know, risk of these contaminants. Obviously, highly purified fish oil eliminates the contamination that you would be consuming. So I think it, all of this leads to greater recommendations on the importance of getting our omega-3 fatty acids from fish oil so you can, you know, get all the benefits of reducing your risk of heart disease, you know, supporting joint health, brain health, you know, healthy skin, and all the wonderful things that we get from omega-3 fatty acids. So that's my one part of the presentation about the safety of our seafood supply. So as I said, along with that and your water, you're probably thinking, oh dear, what's left to eat? And I guess as I want to wrap up tonight, I want to talk too about what you eat and how that affects climate change. Les started this presentation tonight talking about our environmental stewardnesses, however you say it, in that, you know, it really does take changing the way we do things. And part of that is the food choices that you do make and really understanding, you know, the cause and the impact of greenhouse gas emissions from our food and agricultural can really help you all make better choices that protect the environment. And, you know, chances are that what's better for the environment is going to be also better for your own health. Found some interesting statistics related to the impact of agriculture and livestock on climate change, such as approximately one-third of the world's human-caused greenhouse gas emissions are estimated to come from agriculture and forestry. Livestock production alone is responsible for an estimated 18% of the world's greenhouse gases. More than the contribution of transportation, and this is according to the UN Food and Agricultural Organization. And when it comes to food, carbon dioxide isn't the only greenhouse gas of concern. There's methane, there's nitrous oxide, which also contribute. And so some of the most important reasons in relationship to this is, and it's interesting, you know, you probably have heard about cow belching and the enteric emissions and manure from cows and other animals like that produce a significant amount of methane emissions. The production of dairy and of meat from other animals also causes substantial greenhouse gas emissions, but beef production is the most significant. In terms of deforestation, we know that when land is deforested, that the carbon that's been trapped in the soil and the plants gets released into our atmosphere, and that has an impact. In areas of extensive deforestation, you know, in tropical rainforests, where the land is often used for animal pasture and crops and growing animal feed, are often for export, you know, have been of particular concern. How food is grown, processed, and packaged has an impact. In some interesting statistics, in the United States, it takes about 13 calories of fossil fuel inputs to produce every calorie of food that we eat, and 25 calories per calorie of meat. So we're using a lot of energy to produce, you know, meat. And this comes from extensive energy, extensive factors like manufacturing, fertilizers, farm mechanistic stuff, processing and packaging. And a study in Sweden actually found that a third of total energy inputs for food went to making sweets, snacks, and drinks, so food that has very low nutritional value. Another thing to consider is how food is transported. Food travels around the globe at a significant fossil fuel cost, and agricultural imports and exports continue to rise. And a recent study following produce from production to the point of sale found that conventional produce traveled on average 35 times farther than local produce. And to give an example, carrots themselves traveled 27 miles when locally sourced, while they traveled over 18,000 miles when they were 1,800 miles, excuse me, when they were sourced conventionally. So, you know, it makes the case for eating local. Some other factors to consider, and I found this one kind of just astonishing, this statistic, is just the energy costs of refrigeration, of freezing, of home preparation, and the fact that a large proportion of short shelf life foods are often wasted. According to the USDA, more than 25% of the edible food available for human consumption in the United States goes to waste, meaning that all those greenhouse gases that were produced for nothing because we're wasting that food. So what can we all do about it? Well, some of the suggestions are, you know, to eat less cow meat, less beef. This is probably the most important step that you can take. One estimates that if U.S. meat consumption would need to drop by nearly two-thirds by 2050 to stabilize livestock-related greenhouse gas emissions. And for all of those of you that might be meat eaters that aren't ready to give it all up, you could consider joining the Meatless Monday campaign that is being advocated for, just to reduce your meat consumption by 15%. And, of course, reducing meat consumption can also provide some added health benefits by reducing fat and cholesterol and some of the things that do not promote our health from eating animal protein and meats. Eating food that's seasonal, that's local, that's relatively unprocessed and produced with fewer chemicals when feasible. Such foods like that tend to have a lower carbon footprint. Reducing home-related energy use. You know, if you don't have one already, get an Energy Star refrigerator. Buy more longer shelf-life foods, fewer frozen foods. Reduce your trips to the store. Cook in bulk. Another suggestion is to eat or to reduce your food packaging in plastic bags. Buy food with less packaging. Bring your own bags to the store. Bring your own mug, water, bottle, your utensils, and eat takeout less often. And, of course, eat less and waste less. We could all lose some weight by eating less, so that's another reason to do that. And you can reduce the food waste per capita that continues to rise by eating less and getting rid of those unnecessary calories that contribute to unnecessary greenhouse gas emissions. So that is my part of the presentation today. So, Les, I'm going to hand it back to you to finish up with any additional thoughts that you have.
All right, great. Thanks, Pam. And you didn't ruin my appetite. You made me want to go out and eat healthier. Fortunately, we're here in the Bay Area. We have a lot of those options. And I know as I travel throughout the country, some of these options for healthier eating are maybe tougher to find, but you can find them if you're really looking for them. All right, so what I want to do is go over one other study, one other recent report, and then do a little bit of housekeeping before we run into questions maybe 10 minutes from now. One of the things that we wrote in our message for this call was about a new report from the CDC that sort of good news and bad news for the U.S. population with regard to intake of some essential vitamins and nutrients. And this report is called the Second National Report on Biochemical Indicators of Diet and Nutrition in the U.S. Population 2012. And you can access that on the CDC website, or you can access that on the Health Sciences fan page, Facebook fan page website, where we, I think, link to that study or to that report a few days back, maybe a week ago, where you can actually open the link, get into the study, look at the executive summary, and there's some interesting information in there. Again, there's some good news and bad news, but there's clearly, although the overall U.S. population has some fairly decent levels of vitamins and nutrient intakes across the board, clearly there are some higher deficiency rates in some groups that deserve special attention. This is a report that offers a limited but generally favorable review of the nation's nutrition status, though the findings do not necessarily indicate that people are consuming healthy and balanced diets, only that they're getting the right amounts of nutrients to keep them out of deficiency. The CDC's Division of Laboratory Sciences in the National Center for Environmental Health measured these indicators in blood and urine samples collected from participants in CDC's National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. Data presented for the years 1999 through 2006, with emphasis on newly available data from 2003 through 2006. Again, it's sort of a snapshot of overall nutrition status, and there's a few things that I want to point out that I think are important for some of us to consider as we consider dietary supplementation to fill in sort of some of the gaps that we have in our diet. For example, the report found that deficiency rates for vitamins and nutrients varies by a number of factors, including age, gender, race, or ethnicity, and they can be as high. In fact, one case, there was a 31% 31% of non-Hispanic blacks were deficient in vitamin D, and I'll talk a little bit about that later in terms of how they define vitamin D. And one of the comments from one of the authors talked about research shows that good nutrition can help lower people's risk for many chronic diseases. And for most nutrients, low deficiency rates are encouraging, but higher deficiency rates in certain age and race ethnic groups are a concern and deserve additional attention. And so here are a couple of the areas of note in this particular report. For most nutrition indicators, prevalence of deficiency vary by age, gender, or race, ethnicity. For example, although children and adolescents were rarely deficient in vitamin B12, older adults were four times as likely to be at risk for deficiency as youngsters. Men were 40% more likely to be vitamin C deficient compared to women. And that's interesting because today we actually posted on the Health Sciences Facebook fan page a link to a study that talked about higher intakes of vitamin C being linked to, and 500 milligram being the median dose and 8 weeks being the median duration, was actually linked to lower levels of both systolic and diastolic blood pressure in a meta-analysis or a review of the existing literature out there on vitamin C supplementation and blood pressure. So that's interesting. Non-Hispanic blacks were 10 times more likely, and Mexican-American individuals were four times more likely to be vitamin D deficient compared to non-Hispanic whites. The vitamins with the highest prevalence of deficiency, vitamin B6, iron, particularly in women of childbearing age, and vitamin D across the board, at least as assessed in this report. Those with the next highest levels of deficiencies, sort of in general, were vitamin C and vitamin B12 as well, with vitamin A, vitamin E, and folate as being the least likely to have a prevalence of a deficiency within the U.S. population. Now, one thing I want to mention is, although these numbers may not seem that high, if you look at the specific case of vitamin D, the CDC report defines vitamin D deficiency here as a vitamin D level in expressed in nanomoles per liter as less than 30 nanomoles per liter, which is the equivalent of 12 nanograms per ml. And actually, what we typically consider, not just Shackley, but many scientists in the field believe or have identified a level of vitamin D insufficiency as less than 30 nanograms per ml, which is basically almost three times as high as what they're identifying as the deficiency level here. So although they say that, for example, 31% 31% of blacks may be vitamin D deficient. Gee, I bet that number goes way, way up when you look at the level who, at the amount of people who have a suboptimal intake, basically from all ethnicities, and we know that those numbers are much, much higher. So that when you look at the data, even though they're somewhat promising in terms of overall diet, we really don't know if people are eating the right types of foods, and we certainly know that optimal intakes of many of these nutrients should be much, much higher. And that's what, you know, we're all about here, is trying to provide the information and the education to help you make informed choices with regard to supplementation now and health. And now, so I want to make a couple of announcements and a couple of things. Number one, I want to remind everyone that we have our field support specialist line. That group is managed by product specialists. And have get a lot of training with our health sciences team led by Torrance Rogers. That phone number that they can be reached at is 925-734-3638. And we have recently extended the hours because it has been very popular and very high demand. So we have extended the hours 1 hour earlier and 1 hour later, so that we are now available 9 to 4, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Pacific time, Monday through Friday. And we're ready to take your calls and help you out. And this is your quickest way to get sort of basic core product questions. Call there first, and you can get your answer immediately relative to specifically nutritional products. Now, I want to talk about different events.
Are we getting ready for Q&A?
Yeah, we are going to get ready for Q&A in a few minutes.
Shame. Set it up and then.
Okay, so Shane, why don't you go ahead and tell us how to tell people how to line up for Q&A. I have just a couple more announcements, and while I do that, people can start sort of lining up and sort of get in the queue for asking questions of our health sciences team here.
Certainly, at this time and throughout the call, if you have a question or comment, simply press the number 1 on your touchtone phone. Be aware that pressing number 1 more than once will remove you from the queue, so be sure to press it just once, unless your question has been answered by a previous caller, and we'll get to everyone in the order that they are received.
Okay, so I do have a couple of announcements with regard to events that are coming up. Dr. Jamie, one of the reasons she's not with us is she is traveling. She is on her way back east to the Boston area to be in Andover. For the Transform Your Life meeting, which is occurring this Saturday, April 14th, at the Wyndham Andover, and that's starting at 9:30 a.m. On April 21st, she has another meeting of Families Nutrition Needs, and this is at the Hilton Garden Inn in Richardson, Texas. That's just north of Dallas. That happens at 10 a.m. I believe it is with our good friend and senior master coordinator, Marilyn Baer. So certainly to be a treat in Dallas or Richardson, just north of Dallas, on April 21st. On Saturday, April 21st, I will be in Chesapeake, Virginia, for a Saturday of Shackley at 9 a.m. at the Greenbrier Spring Hill Suites. And then the week after, on April 28th, on Saturday, I will be at the... We're having a meeting at the Regency Lodge and Suites, I believe, in Omaha, and that'll be my first time there, and that is with Joanne Boltinghouse and others as well, and we have a Saturday morning program. Hope you can join us. Also in Boston, in the Andover meeting, you're also going to have Senior Master Coordinator Marilyn Baer there, and in Dallas... or in the Richardson event with Dr. Jamie in Dallas is going to be Carolyn Sparger, Senior Master Coordinator Carolyn Sparger in Dallas, and Marilyn is going to be in the Boston Andover event. At my event in Chesapeake, I know that I'm privileged to be able to have and work with Bo Short is going to be at that meeting, and a host of other people at the Omaha meeting. I know Heidi Ode's going to be there, and there'll be some other masters and important leaders as well. So with that, I want to wish everyone a very happy spring, a very happy Earth Day on the coming up in another week and a half or so, and I want to encourage everyone to get out and celebrate Earth Day and do something good for the Earth and do something good for the planet and something good for you and your family as well. So with that, let's go ahead and open it up to questions.